Julie picked up her cell when he called again. "Sydney, are you okay?" He was worried about her. He'd seen the look of desperation on her face when she left work. "Yes, I'm okay," she repeated mechanically in a rough voice. The wine had had little effect. She wasn't a drinker, and alcohol usually hit her pretty hard. "How's Sabrina?"
"Terrible. What would you expect?"
"We pulled everything for modification. I confirmed it before I left the office. And Paul wants to make it up to you, however he can."
"He can't get her job back,"
Sydney said in a tone of deep despair.
"And I can't afford to quit. Isn't that a joke? I'd be worth more to them now dead than alive. I'm not doing anyone any good."
Her thoughts sounded disjointed and very dark.
"Don't talk like that,"
he said, feeling a wave of panic rush over him. His best friend and first lover had committed suicide when they were in college, and he had gotten her drift.
"They need you. You're their mother. They have no one else." "I just cost my daughter her job. She loved that job. And I can't even help her. I'm dead broke. I'm just a headache for them now."
"Every firm in New York is going to want her as soon as they hear she was fired. She's one of the hottest young designers in the States. What are you doing right now?" "Planning to kill myself," she thought, but didn't tell him.
"Nothing. I'm having a glass of wine."
She sounded dangerously bad to him. "I'm coming over."
"Why?"
She didn't want him interfering with her plan.
"You can't. I'm busy."
But Ed wasn't going to let it happen. Not a second time in his life. He'd been at the library, studying, when his lover had committed suicide, because he didn't have the courage to tell his parents he was gay. He had preferred to die instead. They were 20, and it had marked Ed forever. He hadn't been in a committed relationship since. He was too afraid to. "I'll be there in 5 minutes," he said, and hung up on her. He was there 7 minutes later. He didn't live far away, and he had run as fast as he could to get to her apartment. He could see how devastated she was when he got there. She still had the bottle of pills in her hand, and he took them away and shoved them deep into his pocket. "You can get drunk if you want, but you can't kill yourself. You'll only make it worse for them. You have to stick around and help them. They're not old enough to lose you," he said sensibly, worried about his friend.
"This will blow over. She'll get another job. I'm not even sure they can enforce a non-compete firing her like this, because they can't prove she sold us anything. She didn't. A good lawyer will get a big severance package for her because of this. This wasn't her fault. Why don't you stick around and help her with that?"
Sydney looked at him remorsefully, and he saw sanity begin to return.
"I'm sorry I dragged you over here," she said, apologetic. "You didn't. I came because I wanted to. Why don't you go to bed? I'll sleep on the couch tonight."
He went to the bathroom then and flushed the pills so she couldn't take them while he was sleeping. He didn't trust her. She still looked ravaged, although she'd calmed down a little. She melted into his arms then and started to cry. And he held her while she sobbed. It was all too much for her, and he was her only friend now. He put her to bed with her clothes on and lay down next to her. He held her until she fell asleep, and then went and lay on her couch. And when he woke up, she was sitting next to him, looking battered, with dark circles under her eyes.
"I'm sorry. I think I kind of lost it last night. I wasn't even drunk. I just had a few sips.
I know, he said gently. Sabrina's going to be okay.
He tried to reassure her.
Do you mind if I take the day off today?
She asked, and he shook his head.
I'm not leaving you alone. I don't trust you. You're coming to work. I need to be there.
He was her self-appointed bodyguard now.
I'm fine. Really.
I'm not convinced. Tell me that when you're dressed and have makeup on and you're sitting at your desk. She groaned when she stood up to go and take a shower, and then she turned to look at him gratefully.
Thank you. You saved my life last night. I was going to do something stupid.
He nodded with tears in his eyes, remembering his friend.
I know you were.
He pointed at the bathroom then, and she padded off to take a shower. He handed her a cup of coffee when she came back, wearing jeans and a black sweater. She looked better, but still not great. Sabrina called a few minutes later. They had offered her her job back, but she was so upset about the unfair accusations that she had decided to get a hefty severance package with a non-compete so she could look for a new job.
Maybe this is for the best in the end, Sabrina said, sounding better than her mother. I'm going to stick it to them, Mom.
Sydney laughed, relieved to hear her daughter in fighting mode. Sydney looked a lot better when she and Ed left the apartment half an hour later.
I'll treat you to a cab, he offered generously, and hailed a taxi.
As they headed downtown, she didn't say anything, but she reached over and held his hand, and he leaned down and kissed her on the cheek.
You scared the shit out of me last night,
he whispered to her, and she nodded. She had scared herself, too. All she'd wanted was to die. And if he hadn't come over, she probably would have. It was a sobering thought as the cab wove through traffic, and the two of them sat silently in the back seat, holding hands.
Chapter 6 When Sydney got to the office the day after Sabrina had been fired, Paul took her to lunch and laid out his plans for her. He was deeply apologetic over what had happened. He renewed his offer of a line of her own, a full signature line for Sydney with profit sharing. He also had a new project he wanted to discuss with her to convince her to stay. He said it was a line of extremely well-made leather goods, copies of expensive purses at great prices, and he was going to put her name on them, too. He said they were the best copies he'd ever seen. They were made in China, and he was offering her a share of the profits on the new line of purses, too. He said it was an opportunity for her to make some real money. Lady Louise was well known for their high-quality leather goods at impressively low prices, and they sold out every time. She told Ed about it after her lunch with Paul. He wants me to be in charge of the line and put my name on them. I don't know anything about leather goods. I've never dealt with bags before, Sydney said, looking intrigued but nervous. He was luring her into areas she wasn't familiar with that he said were big money makers. How do they look? Ed asked her, curious about the purses. Paul hadn't mentioned the project to him yet, but he knew that the purses they brought in from China always did well and had a high-priced, quality look. I don't know. He said he'd show me this afternoon. He already has samples at the warehouse. He's having someone drive them in. Paul called both of them to his office later, and they were startled when they saw the bags laid out on a table. They looked like expensive designer bags, the real deal, and even better than the ones they usually sold. "Who's been making these?" Ed asked him, checking out the silk linings, and Paul mentioned a firm they'd never used before. Ed examined them closely, and so did Sydney. The workmanship was beautiful. There were four different styles, in shapes they all recognized by a familiar high-end brand. Ed opened them and looked for signs that they were real designer bags and not copies, but there were none. He looked impressed and pleased when he nodded at Paul.
"They're great," Ed complimented him.
Paul was going to call them the Sydney Smith line for Lady Louise, and he quoted an unbeatable price for the purses that their customers wouldn't be able to resist.
"I need you to go back to China and sign them up for production. We have to get them from the supplier. We don't have the machinery to make leather goods like that in our factories," he explained to Sydney,
and Ed confirmed it. The bags were a more sophisticated product than they'd made so far, even though they were cheap.
"When do you want us to go?"
Ed was worried.
"I've got production meetings here for the next month, lookbooks to oversee, and we're already up to our ears getting ready for the presentation of the fall line."
They worked almost a year ahead, like every other major design firm.
"I can't go back to China yet."
He looked panicked at the thought and overwhelmed by his work.
"I need Sydney to go over in the next 2 weeks," Paul said practically. "I don't want to wait. The bags are already manufactured, so all we have to do is pick the styles and colors we want and import them. They won't do modifications on these styles, and we don't need them to. The bags are gorgeous. Sydney can handle it. The company that makes them is a couple of hours out of Beijing. We'll get her a translator and a driver. She can manage without you this time," he said confidently. But Sydney wasn't so sure. He was giving her a lot of responsibility, and going to China without Ed was going to be difficult. He knew the customs so much better than she did. But the opportunity Paul was giving her was so enormous that Sydney didn't dare turn him down. It was a challenge she'd have to meet. She and Ed talked about it on the way back to the design floor, and he looked worried about her.
"Think you can do it? It's a lot of paperwork to export them. And he wants you to make sure that what they're manufacturing is as good as what we've just seen. We don't want a bait-and-switch, where the product they ship is inferior to the samples we saw. I haven't handled the bags before, and I don't know this supplier."
"They do beautiful work," Sydney commented. They looked like some bags she had herself and had sent to storage. They were almost too good to be true, and Ed said they were the best copies he'd ever seen. Paul swore by them and loved the price and said he was doing Sydney a favor, giving her the project, and Ed agreed. With profit sharing, the bags could be a windfall for her. Paul had told her she only needed to stay in Beijing for 2 days, and they would have it all set up for her. Translator, driver, good hotel. She had an appointment with the manufacturer. All she had to do was inspect the bags, pick the ones they wanted, fill out the customs documents, arrange for shipping to New York, and get back on a plane. She left a week later, and everything went smoothly on the way to Beijing. There was a car waiting for her at the airport to take her to the hotel, and the translator appeared the next morning to join her at the meeting. The bags they showed her were of the same high quality she'd seen in New York, in the same familiar shapes, with only the shoulder straps slightly different from the ones they'd copied by a well-known designer. It was going to be a fabulously successful line, and the wholesale price was incredibly low. Lady Louise was going to make a fantastic profit on the new bags, which was what Paul loved about them, and having her name on them was an incredible opportunity for her. She got back on the flight to New York on schedule. They had promised that the bags would arrive within 2 weeks. They were shipping them air freight. She reported everything to Ed as soon as she got home. The trip had gone without a hitch. She'd bought 200 of the bags, which was a lot for a new item they hadn't tried out yet, but the price was so low, she could afford it on the budget Paul had given her. And she was sure they would be a huge hit, and they would be buying many more in future. She'd signed all the purchase orders, since Ed wasn't with her, and the customs documents. Going to China on her own had given her new self-confidence. And Paul said he was impressed with how efficient she'd been. She called Sabrina and Sophie the night she got home. Sabrina had just interviewed at a firm where she'd always wanted to work,
and had signed an excellent severance package, with her lawyer's help and some heavy negotiation and legal threats against the employer that had fired her. They had accused her prematurely, with no proof, and damaged her reputation. They had given her 2 years' salary with no restrictions and a no-non-compete clause, a vital benefit for her. She was thrilled. And Women's Wear Daily had printed an apology to Sabrina, after being threatened by her lawyer. "I think you did me a favor, Mom," she said on the phone, and Sydney was relieved. They had snatched victory from the jaws of defeat. She shuddered, thinking that she'd almost killed herself out of remorse and guilt the night that Sabrina had been fired. So much had happened to her in recent months, and suddenly it was all too much. Costing Sabrina her job had been the last straw. Sophie didn't answer when she called her, and as soon as Sydney hung up, Veronica called her. She had heard from her contractor that Kelly was doing a major remodel on the house before she moved in, and thought Sydney should know. "It's her house now. She can do whatever she wants," Sydney said. "To tell you the truth, I don't really want to know about it. It just upsets me to think about the changes she's going to make. There's nothing I can do, and I don't want progress reports about it once she gets started," she warned Veronica.
"I thought you'd want to hear about it,"
Veronica said again, sounding miffed. She was the only person from Sydney's past life who still called her, but she only called when there was something upsetting to relate. She was the constant bearer of bad tidings, and she managed to slip in with her pseudo-sympathetic voice that everyone was saying Andrew had left her nothing and she was broke, which upset Sydney, too.
"They probably think that because you went back to work, but what else are you going to do? You might as well keep busy since you have no husband and no house to run anymore."
Their conversations always took the same negative turn to unhappy issues for her, and Sydney guessed that if it was true that people were talking, the rumor had probably been started by one of her stepdaughters.
"I like working," Sydney said, which sounded stupid, even to her.
"I read somewhere that Sabrina got fired from her job," Veronica said in a snotty tone, to get even for Sydney not wanting to hear about the remodel of the house.
"Not really. She had a disagreement with them, and they acted hastily. They recanted the next day. In the end, she quit. She's interviewing with other firms now."
Sydney wondered why she always felt compelled to justify herself to Veronica. Both of her own daughters were perennially unemployed, and one was getting a divorce. Why wasn't she explaining that? Why was Sydney's misfortune always her focal point of interest?
"And what have you been up to?" Veronica persisted.
"I just got back from China for the second time," Sydney said, feeling pleased with herself for what she'd accomplished.
"I guess you don't have time for your old friends anymore," Veronica said, sounding insulted as though Sydney had slighted her, when in fact she was working and trying to keep her head above water.
"Not at all. My old friends haven't called me since Andrew died," Sydney tossed back at her. It was true. She'd been very hurt by it at first, but was too busy to think about it now.
"They probably don't want to intrude," Veronica suggested.
"Or you were right the first time when you said they wouldn't want a single woman around. I haven't heard from a soul." And she no longer cared. She had enough on her mind, but she didn't like the idea that they were saying she was broke. It made her sound like a loser. But if Kira and Kelly were saying it, there was nothing she could do to stop them. And, in fact, it was true. Veronica promised to call soon and hung up then. Sydney hoped she wouldn't, but didn't have the guts to say it to her. Somehow, whatever mood she was in, it always made Sydney feel worse whenever Veronica called.
At least she didn't drop by in New York. She never came to the city. For the next 2 weeks, Sidney worked closely with Ed on preparing the presentation of the new clothing line for the fall, and she was working on inspiration sketches for the Sidney Smith line they were developing. They still had a long way to go. Her line of signature purses would be presented first and would be a good test of how strong her name was. She had Thanksgiving dinner with Sabrina and Sophie at the restaurant at the Greenwich Hotel, close to where the girls lived. It was their first Thanksgiving without Andrew, and predictably hard. Sidney was happy to get into bed that night after dinner when she got home, and grateful that the day was over. She bounced back and forth between missing him acutely and remembering every happy moment they'd ever shared, and at the opposite extreme, being angry at him for the life of financial insecurity she led now, constantly worried about money and trying to pay her expenses and bills on what she earned because he had left her nothing else. It reminded her of when she was first divorced 22 years before, trying to make ends meet. But at least this time she didn't have two little girls to support. She had managed well on her salary then, and Andrew had come along and made everything easy for her when they got married. He had led her into a life of luxury she had never aspired to, but had gotten accustomed to. And then on his death, he had tossed her into the deep end of the pool, without a penny. And the only asset she had was an apartment in Paris she couldn't find a buyer for. She spent a lazy weekend at home, reading after Thanksgiving. It rained all weekend, and she was happy to be at home in her tiny apartment, which had begun to feel like home and a cozy cocoon. On Thursday morning, their customs broker called her. Their bags had arrived from Beijing, all 200 of them, and since she had signed the customs documents in China, he wanted her to clear them with him. She told Ed where she was going shortly before noon. He had a mountain of things on his desk and half a dozen designs on his computer screen and looked distracted. "Call me if you have any problems," he said vaguely as she left for U.S. Customs at the airport. "I won't," she reassured him. "The broker will be with me. Everything was very straightforward at the other end." She sounded confident. "You never know with customs. They get upset with some minor detail, a zipper or the thread content of the lining. It depends on their mood of the hour and the alignment of the stars that day, and if the customs agent wants to do it by the book." "I'm sure it will be fine." She had never cleared a shipment on her own, and normally she wouldn't have had to, except that she had filled out all the forms and signed every document herself, as Paul had instructed her to, since he'd made her responsible for the line, and it was a first for her. She ran into Paul as she left the building on his way to lunch, and he smiled broadly when he saw her. He looked very dapper in a dark gray suit with a white shirt and red tie, a beautifully cut overcoat, and shoes she recognized as John Lobb by Hermes. He never skimped on himself. He sold low-priced goods, but bought the best for his personal use. And his wife had the reputation of costing him a fortune, which he complained about good-naturedly from time to time. But he seemed to accept the high cost of marriage and divorce as a fact of life. "Where are you off to?" he asked easily as she hurried to the Uber car she had called, waiting at the curb.
"The airport customs to clear our bags. They arrived. The broker just called me."
She knew that Paul would be pleased. She'd bought them in black, brown, a natural color, and a few in red. And she agreed with him that they were going to be their new hot item for Christmas. They were beautifully made. Even the lining was attractive, in matching high-quality silk.
"Let's get them into the stores as soon as we can," he said, and then hurried off with his collar turned up against the cold. She nodded agreement and got into the car.
She gave the driver the address of the customs office at the airport and sat back to answer emails on her iPad, since she had the time. There was one from Kelly and Kira's attorney, demanding payment for the carpeting she'd already told them she wouldn't pay for, since they had the house now. He kept saying that her stepdaughters didn't like the color and wanted it replaced. She forwarded it to Jesse Barkley and asked him to respond again. She was not going to pay them a penny. But they kept trying, and she had to pay Jesse for his time out of her own pocket, since the estate wouldn't pay him. But it was cheaper than giving them money she didn't owe them and didn't have. It took them 40 minutes to get to the airport from Hell's Kitchen, and their customs broker was waiting outside for her when she got there. "Did they release the goods to you?" she asked him, hopeful that they had, and he shook his head. They were going to the office for commercial shipments. "They said they have to see you in person. They're being a pain in the ass." She wasn't surprised and strode inside the building with the broker right behind her. She had never met him before. His name was Dan Parker. There were 3 customs agents waiting for her when they walked in, and they asked to see her identification. They wanted to know if it was her signature on the documents, and she confirmed it. They could see that it was. "Did you purchase these purses for commercial use?" one of them asked her, and she started to feel annoyed, but was polite. "Yes, we purchased them wholesale directly from the manufacturer in China. I went over to do the transaction myself and approve the finished product." She didn't want to admit that they were knockoffs, or they might accuse her of bringing in counterfeits, exact copies. But these bags weren't illegal. They complied with all the norms for copied goods, made in cheaper leathers, with different linings from the originals and different shoulder straps. She had inspected them herself according to Ed's specifications and Paul's directions. The second agent held up one of the bags for her to identify, and she confirmed that it was one of their shipment. It happened to be a brown leather bag with a brown silk lining that differed from the original brand that had been copied. The originals, she knew, were lined in high-grade leather. And as she watched him, the agent sliced open the lining with a knife and removed it and laid it on the counter, and Sydney didn't look happy about it. She would be even less so if they removed all the linings because they didn't like the fabric content or charged her higher duty. "You're not supposed to damage the merchandise," she reminded him. "Take a look at the inside of that bag," he said, his eyes expressionless as he watched her. And she glanced inside and saw the familiar leather lining she recognized from the similar bag she owned herself by the original designer. There was a small silver plaque with the name of the expensive brand it had supposedly been copied from, with the clearly marked words, "Made in Italy." She looked up at the agent in amazement, not sure what to make of it. The lining had obviously been carefully fitted and sewn in to hide the original interior of the bag with the famous brand name of the maker, and it did not appear to be a counterfeit. It looked like the real deal, the original bag, to Sydney. Clearly, someone had altered the handle and masked the lining to disguise it. "And you're not supposed to be bringing stolen goods into the country," he said coldly, in response to her complaint about his removing the lining.
"I didn't see any sign of that when I inspected them in China," she said in a much smaller voice.
"Who added the shoulder straps and lining to disguise them?" he asked her.
"They were sold to us as modifications of the original design when they were copied," she answered, suddenly confused by what was happening. "There was nothing to indicate that they weren't what they claimed they were. Good-looking copies."
"Very good-looking," the first agent commented, with a scornful expression. "We've seen products from this outfit before. They're either counterfeit or stolen. These aren't counterfeit, so they're stolen." Once the lining was removed, all the markings were evident.
They were expensive bags that were being sold for a fraction of what they were worth and would have been sold for by their rightful maker. They were obviously stolen goods being sold in large volume to be distributed in the States. An outfit like Lady Louise could sell many more bags than the black market could handle.
Then clearly we got burned when we bought them.
Her voice wavered a little, while Paul's customs broker watched her and didn't say a word.
I'll have to call my employer about this. He won't be happy.
In fact, what they had spent on them had gone up in smoke. It was clear to her that the customs officers were going to confiscate them and prosecute the people who had sold them.
Your employer's name isn't on these documents, the agent told her. Yours is.
And as he said it, he took a pair of handcuffs off his belt and clipped them on her wrists before she could react or object, as she stared at him in horror.
You're under arrest, Sidney Wells, for trafficking in stolen goods.
He read her her rights as her eyes filled with tears, and she turned to the broker with a look of desperation.
Call Mr. Zeller immediately and tell him what just happened. Do you have his cell phone number?
Her voice was trembling as he shook his head, and she told him the number from memory.
Tell him to get a lawyer and get me out of here ASAP.
This wasn't her problem. It was his. She had purchased the bags for him, and they'd been planning to put her name on them, which panicked her even more. Then she turned to the agents again. One of them was calling for a female agent on his walkie-talkie.
"Can I make one phone call?"
she asked them, praying that they'd let her.
"To your attorney?"
she nodded, lying to them. She was going to let Paul's attorneys handle it, but she wanted to call Ed Chin and tell him she'd been arrested. She knew he'd find Paul and get her out immediately.
"All right, one call," they conceded, and handed her a phone.
She called Ed's cell phone, and he picked up on the second ring while she prayed it wouldn't go to voicemail. He sounded busy and distracted.
"I just got arrested at the airport," she rushed to tell him. "The bags aren't knockoffs. They're stolen Prada. The manufacturer put in a fake lining to conceal it. If you cut it out, all the markings are clearly there. That explains the high quality. Fuck the bags. Find Paul and get me out of here. They arrested me because I signed all the import documents."
Paul had told her to sign everything, and she suddenly wondered if he had known what he was doing when he sent her. She couldn't believe that of him. But he had let her bring them in on her own and take the fall when they got caught. Surely he didn't know they had been stolen either. They had been duped by the merchant in China.
"Are you kidding? Where are you now?"
Ed asked, incredulous, when she told him what had happened.
"At the Commercial Customs Office, at the airport."
The female agent had appeared by then. She was a hulking woman who looked extremely unpleasant. And Sidney's expensive shearling coat and Hermes boots didn't impress her.
"Are you taking me somewhere?"
she asked them, and one of them answered and told her to wind up the call.
"We're taking you to a federal holding facility here at the airport. We'll take you to the federal jail in the city tonight. Your attorney can see you there tomorrow."
"Can he see me here now?"
All three of them shook their heads. And she told Ed and where she was going.
"You have to find Paul right away. They can't arrest me. I was shipping the bags as an agent for the company. He has to take responsibility for this. I'm not going to. Find him, Ed, please."
She was terrified of what would happen to her now.
"I'll take care of it this minute. And Sidney, I'm so sorry. I never should have let you go back to Beijing alone. Just sit tight. We'll get you out by morning."
"Oh, my God, I have to spend the night in jail?"
She was panicked.
"I'll see what I can do tonight."
He wanted to kill Paul Zeller for letting Sidney put herself on the line.
There was always the risk that goods were counterfeit or stolen when buying cheap copies, especially in Asia. She should have never signed the export documents. The manufacturer should have. But Sydney's name was all over them. The female agent took the phone away from Sydney then, handed it back to her co-workers, confiscated Sydney's handbag, and led her outside to a waiting car to move her to the holding facility. She pushed Sydney roughly into the back of the car, which looked like any ordinary police car, except that it was marked Department of Homeland Security, with a government insignia and an eagle on it, and they drove half a mile away to a building marked U.S. Customs. Inside, it looked like a jail, with bars everywhere. It was used to hold drug dealers, they apprehended, and other criminals, and there was a small area for women. There was only one other woman in the cell they put her in. They had found 500 grams of heroin on her, taped between her legs, and she started screaming at the customs agent as soon as she saw her. She was demanding a lawyer. Sydney felt as though she had been dropped into someone's nightmare, and surely not her own. Her cellmate in what looked like a cage appeared to be in her 20s, and turned to Sydney to ask her what she was in for.
"There's been some confusion about stolen purses."
Sydney felt ridiculous as she said it, and the other woman laughed.
"There's been some confusion about half a kilo of heroin taped to my crotch," she said, and started shouting again.
But no one came to help them, and all Sydney could hope was that Ed and Paul would do something quickly and get her out. This just couldn't be happening, and it wasn't her fault. It never even occurred to her that Paul Zeller might have known that the purses were stolen, and he had knowingly used her, an innocent, to get them into the country.
Chapter 7. As soon as Ed hung up on Sydney's call, he raced downstairs to Paul Zeller's office and was told by his assistant that he was out to lunch and probably wouldn't be back for another hour.
"Find him," he said tersely.
The idea that Sydney had been arrested and was being taken to a federal jail was unthinkable, and he wanted to get her out immediately, not just as her boss, but as her friend. This was the last thing he wanted to happen to her, and he kept wondering over and over again if Paul had known that the bags were real and probably stolen. The supplier had given him a fantastic deal on them, but Ed couldn't believe Paul would set Sydney up like that and let her take the risk of bringing in stolen goods. He felt guilty for what he was thinking. But whatever he thought, they had to get a lawyer and get her out and untangle the mess about the allegedly stolen bags. There was a huge market for stolen goods in the fashion industry, particularly leather goods of all kinds. Vuitton, Chanel, Prada, Gucci, it happened to all of them. Thefts were committed, and the bags were trafficked all over the world, and a lot of the stolen articles were shipped from Africa and Asia into Europe and the States. Ed called Paul on his cell phone, and it went to voicemail. He paced up and down outside his office, and was waiting for him when he got back from lunch, looking relaxed and pleased, and he seemed startled to see Ed, visibly upset and tense.
"Sydney got arrested in customs. The bags are stolen goods. Her name is all over the documents, so they arrested her. You've got to call a lawyer and get her out. The poor woman doesn't deserve this. She's been there since 1 o'clock.
And it was almost 4 by then. The words came out in a rush. Ed had been going crazy waiting for him. Paul indicated to Ed to follow him into his office, where he took off his coat, dropped it over a chair, sat down at his desk, and stared at Ed.
"First of all, I had no idea the bags were stolen," he said, clearing himself as the first order of business. "That's beside the point. We can talk about that later. You need to call a lawyer right away. She can't take the blame for a corporate entity.
We were duped by the manufacturer, or at least I assume we were. They can't expect her to take responsibility for it. You have to send someone down there to get her out.
I'm not sure who to call, Paul said slowly. She needs a federal attorney, and to be honest, we don't have one. And he seemed to be in no hurry to find one, much to Ed's dismay.
Has anything like this ever happened before? Ed asked, still looking frantic.
Once, about 5 years ago.
What happened?
The employee got 5 years in prison and served four. That was different. He had knowledge that the goods were stolen, or he suspected it and never warned us. He was getting a commission from the vendor who sold them to us.
Sidney had no idea those goods were stolen, Ed assured him. She's an innocent, and this is all new to her.
But Paul was well aware of that himself. She probably didn't know, Paul conceded, but let's be honest here. She's a sophisticated woman. She knows what expensive handbags look like. She may have recognized what these were, even if you and I didn't, and she didn't say a word about it to me. For all we know, she may have been getting a commission from the vendor to bring them in anyway. You and I weren't in China. We don't know what went on there.
Are you saying she knew these were stolen goods? Are you kidding? She's a babe in the woods. She's a terrific designer, but she's never dealt with purchase and importation. She wouldn't know the difference between a good copy and the real thing. And she trusts us. She had no reason to suspect the merchandise was stolen.
He had no qualms about vouching for her, and no doubt in his mind.
I certainly hope not, Paul said, looking righteous, as Ed began to wonder how much he'd had to drink at lunch.
He was moving very slowly, while Sidney was sitting in a federal jail at the airport.
"Why are we sitting here, talking about this, wasting time? Why aren't you calling an attorney?"
There was a long pause as Paul looked at him. "Ed, have you ever read our employee handbook? We have a very clear policy about incidents like this. If an employee gets arrested in the course of the work they do for us, in any form, at any time, in any country, we are not responsible for their legal counsel, nor to defend them. It is entirely their own responsibility. We can't be responsible for 300 employees who can get arrested at any time for any reason. When you sign your work contract with us, you indemnify us from any responsibility to defend you. Sidney will have to find her own attorney to defend her in this matter. I have no way of knowing if she knew if the purses were stolen or not. I can't vouch for her. The manufacturer may have offered her a cut when she was in China. She may look lily pure, but you never know what people are capable of.
Ed couldn't believe what he was hearing. His eyes looked like they were going to fall out of his head as he listened to Paul. "Are you telling me that you're going to step aside and let her take the fall here? What kind of human being are you? The poor woman was bringing those purses in for you, not to sell on a street corner somewhere, and now she's been arrested for trafficking in stolen goods."
"Maybe the manufacturer or someone else offered her a better commission than I did. But whatever happened, she is responsible for her own defense. We'd go under if I had to provide every employee here legal counsel every time they got in trouble."
"You had her sign all the documents, for Christ's sake!"
Ed was shouting at him, and Paul only nodded.
"You could have had anyone sign them, and I heard you tell her to do it all herself. You used her, didn't you, just in case you got caught on this one? How many times have you done this before and never got caught?"
Ed was livid.
"And now you're not even going to get a lawyer for her?"
"No, I'm not. If she read her employment contract, she would know that."
"What is it? In microscopic print, in Chinese somewhere, on the flip side of the contract? I read contracts very carefully, and I never saw that clause when I signed up.
Then you should have read it more carefully. And so should she, if she decided to take a better commission behind my back or took the responsibility for goods she may have known were stolen. You and I will never know the truth, Paul said. And Ed had to force himself to remain calm so he didn't hit him.
So that's it. You let her take the blame for something you did. You cut your losses over 200 cheap purses that you probably knew were stolen, and she didn't?
Ed realized now that Paul had been testing to see how easy it was to get them in and let Sidney be the one to do it and be responsible if anything happened. It was obvious now that Paul was going to do nothing to protect her. Ed slammed out of his office and went back to his own desk. He wasn't sure what to do, but first he had to find a lawyer for her. And he did the only thing he could think of. He called his youngest uncle in Hong Kong, who was only 10 years older than Ed, waking him up at 6 a.m. Hong Kong time. He explained the situation to him and said he needed to find a federal lawyer for her in New York, and he had no idea who to ask. His uncle had met Sidney with Ed and knew immediately who Ed was calling about.
"And you're sure she had no idea they were stolen goods?"
Ed's uncle sounded fairly cynical and knew what a kind heart his nephew had, and that at times he could be naive. Sidney was, after all, a grown woman who had been in the fashion business. He had to take into consideration that she might be guilty.
"I promise you, the woman is innocent about this kind of business. Her husband died 6 months ago, and I think our shit of an employer set her up and used her as a convenient person to blame if things went wrong."
"That's entirely possible. Is she in need of money?" he asked reasonably. He would explain why Sidney might have taken the risk and made a deal with the manufacturer to bring in stolen goods, and Ed hated to tell him the truth.
"I think she probably is short of money since her husband's death. He died without a recent will, and there were some problems with the estate, but that doesn't mean she'd become a criminal to solve the problem."
"No, but stranger things have happened. And why do you want to find her an attorney?"
"Because our employer isn't going to. I just found out. She has no one else to help her. I'm her boss, and she's my friend."
"I'll see what I can do," he promised. "I'm not sure I can come up with a name immediately. I'll let you know what I can find out. I have a friend I went to school with at Oxford who's a lawyer in New York. He may know someone who can help her, but she needs a federal defense lawyer who specializes in criminal cases. That's not as easy to find as a good tax attorney. I'll see what I can do. And, Edward, be careful. You may not know this woman as well as you think."
He tried to warn him, and Ed was instantly annoyed.
"Yes, I do."
He thanked his uncle for trying to find a lawyer for him and then walked out of the office at not quite 5 p.m. He didn't tell anyone that he was leaving, and he didn't care. He took a cab home and called the customs office at the airport from the taxi, but all he got was a recording telling him their location and no hours. He thought about going to the airport and trying to see her, but she had already told him he wouldn't be able to, so he called the federal jail in the city instead, and was told that no prisoner by that name had been transferred from the airport yet. They refused to tell him when she might come in. They told him to call in the morning. All he could do now was wait to hear from his uncle with the name of a federal criminal attorney, or for Sidney to call him herself. Until then, there was nothing he could do. By 6 o'clock, Sidney had been in the cell of the airport federal customs facility for 5 hours. She had heard from no one. No attorney had shown up. The customs broker had left as soon as they took her away, and she hadn't been able to get calls from Paul Zeller or Ed Chin. She was sure that they were both doing everything they could, and a lawyer would show up any minute and get her released. The federal agents who had locked her up told her nothing either. They acted as though she didn't exist.
The only human who would speak to her was the girl who had smuggled the heroin between her legs, and she had lain down on the cot in their cell and gone to sleep. She had flown in from Mexico City, she had told Sidney, and had been awake all night. At 7 o'clock they brought each of them a sandwich on a tray and a bowl of instant soup. They had no catering facility there, and had to buy airport food for their prisoners. It was just a holding tank, and they shipped anyone incarcerated there into the city as fast as they could. At 9 o'clock that night, two female customs agents walked in, handcuffed her and the sleeping drug smuggler, who woke with a start, and led them outside to a small van. They put them in the back to take them to the federal jail in the city. Their valuables, like Sidney's purse, cell phone, watch, earrings, and wedding ring, were in a plastic bag given to the agents who drove them, to turn over to the jail when they took them in. The drug smuggler fell asleep again on the short ride to the city, and Sidney watched the familiar route slide by from behind the iron mesh on the windows. She had never, in her worst nightmares, imagined that she would be in this position, but she was sure that Paul Zeller would straighten it out by the time she got into the city, and she would be released. Instead, when they arrived at the federal jail facility, the Metropolitan Correctional Center on Park Row across from the courthouse on Pearl Street, she and the smuggler were herded into another holding tank with six other women and told to strip. They were in the receiving and discharging area and had each been given a federal register number to identify them. The rules were posted in English and Spanish. Sidney stared at the federal deputies in disbelief. This wasn't possible. It was like a bad dream. The others took off their clothes rapidly and seemed used to the routine. They were all in for various forms of drug charges and crossing state lines with possession with intent to sell hard drugs. One woman was in for trying to smuggle firearms into the airport, and a pale young girl who looked like a teenager was high on crystal meth and had tried to rob a bank with two friends. They were an unsavory-looking group, and all of them stood naked in a matter of minutes in the drafty cell. All the guards were women, and Sidney shivered as she took off her clothes. Within minutes, she was as naked as the others, while a federal officer gathered up their clothes and threw them into plastic bags with their names on them. And then, one by one, handcuffed again, they were led into a dismal-looking room, while six tough-looking female guards stood around and watched. All the guards surrounding them were women, and one of them put on rubber gloves. They were told to bend over and hold their ankles for a cavity search, and for a minute Sidney thought she was going to faint. She forced herself to think of something else while they searched her, and then pushed her toward a shower, handing her a towel, some rough cotton underwear, a denim jumpsuit, and bus shoes. There were tears in her eyes when they took her mugshot, and finally led her to a cell where she was alone. It had a cot, a toilet, a tiny sink, and a shelf with nothing on it. They handed her a toothbrush and a bar of soap, and left her there to wonder what was happening in the outside world, and if help would ever come. She couldn't believe that Paul and Ed had abandoned her, nor could she understand the delay in getting her out. They left the lights on in the jail all night, and she lay awake on the narrow cot, listening to the sounds of the jail around her, the catcalls, the screams, the women who sounded insane, and the conversations among the guards as they walked by. She did breathing exercises to try to stay calm. All she wanted was to be released, and she was sure that by morning she would be. The whole thing was a terrible mistake. She thought of Sabrina and Sophie and was determined not to call them, even if she could. There was no way she was going to call her daughters and tell them she was in jail. Ed's uncle, Philip, called him at 10 o'clock that night. It was 11 a.m. in Hong Kong, and he had finally reached his friend in New York, who who had given him the name of a federal defense lawyer who said he was expensive, but a good guy. He had gone to Harvard Law School with him.
"Are you paying for this?" Ed's uncle asked him.
"No, I'm sure she'll pay for it herself. Our employer certainly isn't going to. Apparently, it's in the small print in our work contracts that if we get in trouble in the line of duty, we're responsible for the legal fees ourselves."
"Nice people you work for," Philip Chin said in a tone of disapproval. "When are you coming home?"
"One of these days."
And then Philip asked his nephew a question he'd been curious about for the past 5 hours.
"Are you in love with this woman?"
Ed laughed.
"No, I'm not. I'm still gay. But I was her immediate superior. I should have protected her. And I didn't. And I feel responsible for her now. We're friends, and she doesn't deserve what happened to her. And I'm not convinced of our boss's innocence. This is all I can do to help. At least I can contact an attorney for her."
"And you're planning to continue working for this man?"
His uncle sounded shocked.
"No, I'm not."
He had made the decision that night while he thought about the whole sequence of events. He realized now that Paul had used Sydney, dazzled her with a profit participation in the sale of the bags, and using her name for a signature line to get the goods into the country and let her take full responsibility in case something went wrong. Sending her to China to sign all the papers and be responsible for the deal had been a way of shifting all the risk onto her, and it had worked. Sydney was in jail now, and Paul was not, and he was even willing to suggest that she might have double-crossed him to make her look guilty and absolve himself, which was even worse. Paul Zeller was a despicable person, and Sydney had been his unwitting victim. There was no way Ed was going to abandon her now. He had a strong suspicion that Paul knew the bags were stolen, and if so, he had probably done it before. Their leather goods were famous for their high-class look. Maybe this was why.
"I just haven't had the chance to tell him yet," Ed said in answer to his uncle's question. "This all happened this afternoon. I haven't even been able to speak to her again since she got arrested."
"If she's innocent," his uncle said cautiously, "this must be a shocking experience for her."
He was beginning to feel sorry for her, if everything his nephew said was true. He had found her to be a kind, charming person when they met, with great dignity.
"I'm sure it has been. The first thing I want to do is get her out of jail, and I'll call the name you gave me tomorrow. I'll let you know how it works out."
"Good luck," Philip Chin said, and then hung up.
And Ed sat staring at the name he'd written down. Stephen Weinstein. He just hoped he could help her and get her off the hook. It was Paul Zeller who deserved to be in jail, not her. Ed sat awake all night worrying about his friend. Ed called Steve Weinstein on his cell phone at 8 a.m. He apologized for calling him so early, and Weinstein said it was fine. He was on his way back from the gym. Ed explained how he'd gotten his name via his uncle in Hong Kong and told him what had happened to Sydney at the airport the day before, and that he believed she was being transferred to the federal jail in New York. "Your employer sounds like a nasty guy," Weinstein said coolly.
"I guess he is. While he pretends to be everyone's best friend, I always thought he had a shady underside, but nothing like this."
"And you don't think it's possible your co-worker had some part in this, or knew what was going on?"
"Absolutely not."
Ed vouched for her without hesitating. "She was a very successful designer until 16 years ago when she remarried."
"Who was she married to, or is she still married?"
"He died about 6 months ago, someone called Andrew Wells."
"Of the investment banking firm?" The attorney sounded momentarily impressed.
"I believe so. She doesn't talk about it a lot. I think there have been problems with the estate, and her husband's daughters by his first marriage. They inherited everything, so she went back to work. Steve Weinstein was thoughtful for a minute.
If she's who I think she is, this is going to get some attention in the press, which will be unpleasant for her until we clean this up. They may use her as an example and prosecute her vigorously to make a point.
Can you at least get her out of jail immediately? She must be totally freaked out. She